Hi, this is Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, and you're listening to Rock the Vote Native Style.
Hey, Wendy.
Hey, I'm here today.
Right. Hey, we got Nancy and Dan Jourdain on later, but we have a special report from the governor of Minnesota. Yeah. Why don't we take a listen?
Yes.
It's going to require aggressive mitigation to avoid additional increases in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. That, once again, is an absolutely predictable, unfortunate, but absolutely predictable outcome if the spread of COVID is not contained. If unmitigated community spread, if we are not testing and contact tracing and isolating folks with cases, we are going to get this. And so over the last about 10 days, we have seen that exponential growth in Minnesota. We've seen it hit record cases of identifying, and that's not just because we're testing more. We kept and did because of the sacrifices of each and every one of you, because Minnesotans have looked out for their neighbors. We were able to keep our infection rates at a much lower rate than a large portion of the country. And if you look at this slide, we saw our peak in May, and we were learning at that time. We did not know a lot about this. We had asked Minnesotans to do a 51-day basically stay-at-home order, and you did that. Our hospitals built capacity. We sourced PPE. We learned how to live with, to a certain degree, what was happening with COVID and adjust our behaviors. And over the subsequent months of June, July, and August, while we saw spikes in the rest of the country, Minnesota remained at about a 5% positivity rate. Well, unfortunately, as you look at this chart, that has changed dramatically. And as we've talked about from the beginning of this, the fear is once you lose control, once you go above 5% positivity rate and you start getting into the neighborhood we're at today of 14.4 or so for today's numbers, you start to see that line go absolutely vertical. If you're looking at this chart at home, this is a one-week lag. When we add what's happened this week to that, this line would go off the top of the television screen here because we are at 6,000 cases, nearly doubled. And again, that type of spread and that type of spike will continue unless we make mitigation efforts. Unless we choose to adjust behaviors that we know the data supports, we'll start to bend that. And we'll also make sure that that our hospitalizations and our capacity remain the same. When this originally started, just like anything that is close human contact, we saw the spread was much higher in urban areas, not surprising. In the upper Midwest, outside of Illinois and Chicago area, Minneapolis is the largest urban area, bigger than about two times bigger than Milwaukee. And if you look at surrounding states like Iowa or Nebraska or South Dakota or North Dakota, much more rural. So in the beginning of this pandemic, you started to see numbers much lower. I would make the case that that lulled people into a false sense of security. Not the team at MDH, not the team at our healthcare partners, not the team at the White House Coronavirus Task Force led by Dr. Birx. We understood early on it would just be a matter of time. And if you're looking at this chart, every corner of our state is being impacted by this, some much more dramatically than others. And the thing that I think most of you out there understand is while we're collaborating together and we have our capacity for hospital space, bed space, and I'll talk a little bit more about the real critical piece of this, those professionals and the staff that are there, they are not equally dispersed across the state. So in some areas, a spike of 100 or 200 cases requiring hospitalizations reaches us to that critical stage where we need to move into surge capacity. And I'd just like to reiterate to Minnesotans, the hard work that you did to buy that capacity is paying off, and it will continue to pay off in the future. You've seen it in states surrounding us where they started to move into their surge capacity. State of Wisconsin set up a hospital at their state fairgrounds. We have that capacity. The professionals you'll hear speak after I'm done here will talk to what that is. So this is not a situation where we're panicked. It is not a situation where people are not going to get care, but it is a situation that it will change dramatically. And our ability to be able to deal with this will change very, very quickly. A couple months ago, I mentioned the surge in Arizona, where Arizona went from 5% positivity rate to 20% positivity rate in about a matter of 2 weeks. And I said that will happen here if we don't make some of the right decisions around this. And I didn't say that because I'm looking to the future or guessing or hoping it would not happen. It's because it is the absolute path of the virus. And so what you're seeing now is where Arizona was around the 4th of July is what appears to look like where Minnesota's at. Just 10 days ago, Minnesota was 21st in infection rates, about in the middle of the country. North Dakota was 1, South Dakota was 2, Wisconsin was 3, Iowa was 4, Nebraska was 5. We will quickly join that group if we don't make the decisions that can mitigate that and start to bring that down. So, excuse me. Talking about the healthcare capacity and this our surge capacity, you're going to hear from Dr. Morris and Dr. Gorelick in just a little bit to talk about what this is. Just to be clear, we don't build out massive amounts of empty hospital space. It doesn't make sense economically. It doesn't make sense space-wise. So our hospital capacity, what we've learned is, whether people have the flu, they're in to give birth, they're having an appendicitis, or God forbid, we have an auto accident, we're able to handle that. And there's enough built into it if certain things happen. But this is not a certain thing. For those who are wondering right now, the first weeks of December tend to be the peak hospitalization periods for flu, and we're starting into that season. As we speak, there are 4 people statewide hospitalized for flu, unlike the 1,200 plus for COVID, and that will certainly go up. What you're looking at is beds in use, capacity in parts of the state, and then beds available. That beds available, I hope everyone's able to see how very, very quickly, with an exponential spread, we've been looking at cases 4 and 5, 6,000, positivity rates now average over 10%, and deaths in ICU capacities going up. It is absolutely heartbreaking, but we can project with some certainty where we're going to be in 10 days and where we would be in 20 days. What we have the capacity to do is start to change that by our behaviors. But you will open your paper and it will not be unusual for you to see 50 or 60 potential deaths based sheerly on the numbers of where we're going. So that's why it is so critical that at this point in time, we take a look at this. And here's what's happened. As it's spread more, obviously more people are going to need hospitalized. We said early on about 15% of people, and this is when we were first learning about COVID, about 15% of people would need hospitalizations and about 5% of them would need ICU capacity. I think that number, and the doctors can probably talk to a little more detail, I think it's probably closer to 10 or 12% need hospitalized and about 2 to 3% need ICU. That's a great testament to the therapeutics that we've come up with, new ways of approaching this, and just sheer will of the healthcare providers to figure out better ways to care. But if the volume increases so dramatically, even that 10 to 12% that need hospitalization or that 2 to 3 that need an ICU will overwhelm us. And the real problem we have is this. While we built up and we have surge capacity, we have N95 masks, we have the proper protective equipment, we're simply running out, and this is what's happened around the country, of personnel, because they're also getting COVID. They're also getting hit by this. And what ends up happening is that our staffing shrinks to the point where it becomes impossible to even fill the rooms if we have them to provide the care necessary. And again, Minnesota, and it's a testament to folks like Dr. Morrison Gorelick, who will be up here in a minute, Minnesota had a better handle on this with a better view of how many beds we had, and we're able to cross-level people to other facilities to be able to get a handle on that. But this is not just isolated to certain areas. It is statewide and nationwide shortage of healthcare providers because of this surge that's happening, especially in the upper Midwest. Well, now this one is, how do we respond? And from the beginning, my pledge to you was to follow the science, to follow the data, to understand the social implications of the decisions we made and what that impact would be, and try and provide a balanced approach. This Venn diagram shows the Stay Safe Minnesota, the well-being, the economy, and controlling the spread, and trying to strike that balance. I told you one of the first times I spoke with you during the stay-at-home order was that could not go on indefinitely. the economic, the social, the health, the mental health aspects of a prolonged stay-at-home order would be too detrimental. We had to find a way that allowed us to find some way of sustainability. Now, for a lot of months, Minnesota was able to do that. But I think the White House Coronavirus Task Force was also deeply worried about us in June and July because they saw us staying flat and not going down. And it felt like there was something was going to have to break at one point or another. And unfortunately, once it came to the upper Midwest, and I think that there's a lot of data starting to be gathered about this, more than likely the thing that many of you know is as we started to move back inside, we started to see the spread happen more. And as Chris Ayersman, our infectious disease director, reminds me often, there's ways that we can reduce the risk, but not eliminate it. And just because reduced risk does not mean no risk. And I think for some of us, all of us, and I include myself in this, that belief that if we just gathered with family in our backyards or just in our dining room, and these are people that we know, that would be okay. What you're going to see is that is not okay. And that's where a lot of this spread is starting to come from. And so in this, that middle piece of this, each of us has a role. This is where, and I continue to say this, if we want to slow the spread of this, if we want to do the things we know that we love to do and have our kids in school, we're going to have to take the ownership of this and bend this curve through proven practices that make a difference. Again, I want to highlight some of you, if you go Google it, I think it's our students in Martin County. A group of students put together a very factual, data-based, scientific approach of what it takes, wearing masks, social distancing, get a test if you need one, isolate, and help communicate with contact tracers to get a handle on this. They were doing that because they said, we want to be in sports this fall. We want to be in school. We want to learn. We want to think about our futures. And they made a video asking their community to help them with this, help by doing some of these things. So I want to just be very clear. Wherever it got that there was a false choice that do you want to play football or go to school or have businesses open or do you want to fight COVID, that was an incredibly poor way of folks to think about this, because the only way we're going to be able to do those things is by containing this virus and defeating it. And we do know that there's some positive light at the end of the tunnel, certainly therapeutics, but potentially the vaccine that are out there. But until that time, it's within our control, and that's what these students were saying. If we want to get back to the things we love, take some control over this and start to do the things that mitigate the spread. So here's what we're seeing. We're seeing spread in every part of daily life in all settings. This diagram just shows, much like that, you may think it's isolated to you, but as I said, with family gatherings, you may be with a brother and sister-in-law, and they may bring one of their children who's been very, very careful, but just happened to have contact with somebody else who they thought they were being very, very careful. And pretty soon you have a network of people where this thing spreads. And we know how it's spreading, and we know where it's at. It's not being caused by one or two major events, but I want to be clear. Whether you're celebrating an election victory in a large crowd or you're storming a football field after a game, those things are incredibly risky. They are things we can't do at this time. And just to be clear, all of it needs to be avoided. But the data seems to show us the who, what, and where that spreading this is much more. We can be much more granular with that now. We can be much more detailed about how we approach it. And here's where it's coming from. And this is just, and I would let the health experts have spent a lot of time with me. This is a very unique, novel coronavirus for a reason. One of the things is the asymptomatic spread is the most pernicious part of this. This is dangerous because we can't see it. We don't know it. And there's a whole lot of folks, especially young people, doing a lot of things right. My goodness, we're asking them not to do the very fun things that make life so enjoyable. And they're doing it for the most part. But it's also lulled us into a sense of a false sense of safety. You don't see it on them. They are not sick. They are legitimately asymptomatic. And they believe, and in many cases, they're doing almost everything right. But they're infected and they are contagious. And that 18 to 35s, as you see on this chart, this is just 1 week in our lag period, a week and a half ago. The bulk of those are under age 35. And while most of them will not end up in the hospital, some will, and while a small percentage of them don't get real sick. Some do and some die. But what's happening is they are spreading it into the older, the more vulnerable populations, and that is where the uncontrolled spread happens. So we know that's where it's coming from. Now, I want to be clear. This is not pointing fingers. This is not blaming. This is young people have been incredibly, as I said with the group in Fairmont, incredibly proactive on trying to help this. But the way this thing is spreading, I think Dr. Birx gave us the number that she felt at some of our universities, the asymptomatic cases may be upwards of 70%. And I think many of us almost fell out of our chair when we heard this, that that was several weeks ago, and she felt that was the case. So the social settings, where 18 to 35-year-old go. What we're seeing is the spread in private social gatherings, weddings, funerals, private parties, and other small things, backyard barbecues, those types of things, and then late night outing to bars and restaurants. And I'd like to make note of that, that we're getting the data so much better at the data on this that we actually know statistically after 9 o'clock when we contact trace that we're seeing a doubling, at least a doubling of infections that are happening after 9 o'clock as opposed to earlier in the evening. And this is where human nature, I let some of you decide on that, how that works is people just get a little more socially lax as the night goes on, and especially in settings where alcohol is served. And again, I am not passing a moral judgment. I'm just simply stating scientifically where the facts are. And if we're going to get a handle on this, we have to know who is spreading it, where they're spreading it, and then, of course, when they're spreading it. So these are the outbreaks that we've seen from June through November. 71% of our spreading cases are happening in private social gatherings, weddings, funerals, restaurants, and bars, and about 29% in other settings, workplace settings and other controlled settings. We've said from the beginning, when people ask, well, why are you keeping these things open and these things not? There was a rhyme and reason to it. And what we know is that if people were able to social distance, if they were able to social distance outside, certainly, but if their contact was very predictable about where they went, what they did, kept the mask on, we knew that there would be a reduction in those types of activities. For example, retail. We're not seeing a lot of spread in retail of people going in and buying a candle, going in and buying groceries. That's not happening. So what makes it so risky? I just think, and for some of you, and I say this, I'm in the same boat as all of you, you think seeing a brother-in-law and sister-in-law at an outdoor patio setting, socially distanced, that that poses very little risk. Now, again, as Director Ehrsman would say is, it poses less risk, but it doesn't pose no risk. And I think what's happened is you become a little more complacent. You're comfortable around these. These are family. If you're in a setting where you're eating or drinking, obviously you have to have your mask off to do that. And the longer you have that mask off, the greater chance you have infected. The more people you add into that mix, the greater chance you have infected. And loud settings, the louder you speak, if you're singing, if you're playing darts, standing next to someone in a crowded bar and you're yelling back and forth, it seems like these things shouldn't be as risky or elevated. What we've seen is that they do that. And then, of course, alcohol lowers inhibitions, social distancing, night wears on. I want to be clear. It's certainly not our intention to demonize any industry or any activity. It's simply important for us to understand what we know 8 months into this, what spreads this thing, who gets it and is more likely to spread it, what's happening with asymptomatic spread, and what is our most targeted approach, our most surgical way of looking at reducing these things, all again to make sure we don't overwhelm the hospital system, we don't overwhelm the staffing that's at those, and we buy ourselves that time towards we get to a vaccine. So here's what we're going to do today. We came to you early on and pledged to put out the data. We have probably one of the most transparent dashboards in the nation around where information is. We've turned our dials. We're going to have to turn them back a little bit today, and that's what we're going to do. By being able to use that more targeted approach, it lets us keep those activities open, both from an economic standpoint, a well-being standpoint, the things we like to do standpoint, but targets very specifically ways that we think we can slow this spread. I would also note that one of the things that will coupled with this is, again, If we want to know who has this, we need to be able to provide testing on a wide scale. And yesterday's announcement was one more addition to that with all of our partners. Minnesota's depth and breadth of testing probably puts us amongst the top states in the country. And we built in the capacity that we controlled our testing by having the labs here. So we're going to have the ability to do this. And I would ask, and we saw this yesterday with our new lab in at the Civic Center in Minneapolis, we'll have 11 opening up at armories across the state. We're trying to eventually get it where you can take the kit home, send it back, and have an answer in 24 to 48 hours. If you're 18 to 35, you're feeling healthy, you've done a lot of things right, but you just want to know because you want to protect your family, you want to protect your neighbors. Almost all Minnesotans are now within 30 minutes of two options to test. And again, this is barrier-free, pain-free, cost-free. Go in there, get it done, get a result, then let's start moving. So what we're going to do is a limit of 10 person for indoor gatherings and outdoor gatherings. That just allows the two together to align. Three households or less, including the host. You mix more households, obviously, it just adds a whole nother dimension, meaning you've got two brother-in-laws and the two sisters-in-laws and yourself. You can bring them in, but I think, again, I keep coming back to this, you have to social distance, you have to wear a mask, and you have to recognize just because they're family and just because you know them, you've not eliminated the risk. And then effective, this will go into effect at 10 p.m. on this Friday. We need to move now. This has happened incredibly quickly. You saw the stories of hospital systems around us that are already overwhelmed. We are still in a position to be able to handle this. There is going to be a lag time. This is the wave already breaking on the shore. What we're able to do is to shore up a little bit to push back after this one breaks for the next one that will come. Receptions and similar events. We're going to do a phased-in approach. Again, just to be clear, weddings and funerals, these are hugely important human activities, and it is incredibly painful not to do them. But what we're seeing is not the actual ceremonies involved in this, but the social gatherings afterwards. And this is a phased approach because, just to be candid with you, some of you have planned your wedding for 6 months or longer. You've planned it since we made some of those changes. Our intention is not to make that difficult for you. It's to make that day special without having it marked by an outbreak of COVID or the problems that come with it. So we'll go to a 50-person limit on the 27th, 25-person limit. And then these events will not happen from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. And there's no change in actual weddings, funerals, other similar ceremonies. Only those things connected with that reception or the celebration piece where food and beverage and those types of things are served. And again, we're not just randomly targeting these things. The data shows that a bunch of our outbreaks are coming from these types of activities. Again, no ill intent by the people involved, but this is how COVID-19 works. Bars and restaurants, indoor and outdoor capacity of 50%, no more than 150 people. Counters are closed for seating and service unless counter service only. Patrons need to be seated at tables. No bar games that require standing is permitted. And again, I just like to say, I've got a 19-year-old who went back and watches kind of an old movie classic, and I feel like the guy in Footloose. No dancing, no fun, no whatever. That is not my intention. My intention is to keep you safe so that you can all dance a lot longer and that our neighbors don't put them at risk. But I recognize this is painful. It's no fun. I'm as frustrated as you are. We should have broke the back of this thing months ago in this country. We have not. But now is the time for us to do it. No dine-in service 10 to 4, but open for delivery and takeout. And I'm just going to say, our hospitality industry has done more than anybody should have ever asked of them. And they have done it so right, and they have gone to great pains, whether it be filtration, whether it be plexiglass, whether it be masking. And this is happening not because they're being lax, but because it's the setting that the virus is most effective at spreading in. And that is incredibly painful. I would encourage all of you, spend money at these businesses. My wife today ordered Thanksgiving dinner for our family from Colossal Cafe, and they're going to provide it, and we'll go pay them and be grateful for what they did. We can all do some of that to keep these folks going, but I think it's really important to recognize they have made every effort possible, and this is going to be painful. This is going to be painful for them, and we can help a little bit. This goes into effect this Friday night at 10 p.m. Here's what we're going to do today, coupled with it, especially targeted for those restaurants and those small businesses being impacted. We have $10 million that's in the Small Business Relief Grant Program. This is money that can move immediately to them as grantees. We know that this does not make them whole. We know the federal government's PPP program helps some of them, but not all. But our hope is to buy a bit of time here. And I'm telling you, folks, if we can break the back on this thing, we can get through this over the next, 4 to 6 weeks. We see some of the promise with the Pfizer announcements and some of that, we can get to the other side of this without putting more people at risk. So this $10 million additional funding, businesses have already applied for relief, help about 1,000 more businesses pay for their bills, pay their workers if they need to. So we have to take the strong steps. I recognize the regulation alone is not going to do it. I'm making the plea to you once again. You've done an incredible job with it, but we can't let down. Whether it's COVID fatigue, whatever it might be, the data supports, and it's there, masks work, social distancing work, keeping indoor gatherings to a smaller number, making some of these smart choices will make a difference. It will save people's lives, it will keep people out of the hospital, and it will allow us to go back to school, keep our businesses open, and get back to normal faster. So I'm asking you, keep those things in mind. Get tested if you think you need it, and let's beat this thing. So I'm going to bring up Dr. Morris in just a moment. You're going to hear from him, Dr. Gorelick, and then Commissioner Groh. But Minnesotans, this is, you deserve to hear where things are at. This is a day we hoped would not come, but hope was not a plan. The state of Minnesota planned for this day. We knew it was there. And here we are. So just like I've said before, we are resilient people. We're pretty gritty. We're pretty tough. We're going to need it now. This is the worst part of the pandemic. The darkest days are going to still be ahead of us here. But what we've learned in the last 8 months and the work that we've done is we can make it much better than it would be if we didn't do that, and we can get to the other side. This is a bridge to potentially the end of this thing. So with that, Dr. George Morris is the Medical Incident Commander at CentraCare, focusing on COVID-19 response.
That was Governor Tim Walz. Thank you, Wendy, rolling your eyes there. amazing.
Yeah, we really have to give him, just say thank you for organizing and keeping us safe. And as hard as it is for us to have to dial back, as he says, we need to do that because our numbers are really big. I like a lot of the things that he said, that the numbers are up, and it's not because we're testing more. It's just the infection rate is up. You know, what we're going to do in our family for Thanksgiving and Christmas is, we have a small family, so it's just a few of us. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, well, Thanksgiving is November 26th, right? So the people who will be coming to our house will be quarantining for 2 weeks before. So they'll start on November 12th. And they're not going to be with other people, and they're just going to do what they normally do, but not see other people. And again, for, Christmas. So Christmas is December 25th. So from December 11th, which is 2 weeks before, the family will hunker down and not be with any other people so that we could be together. So that's what we're going to try to do for our family. And we're going to try to stay safe, and also so we could be together. Together during that time.
Yeah, good call. I just wanted to remind everyone that this is a Rock the Vote Native style. We're going to get with the regular show, but we wanted to comment, and I wanted to bring in the in-house expert, Wendy Pilot.
I am not the in-house expert, for
yeah,
sure.
You are in this house.
Well,
there you go. Hey, bars and restaurants, 50% capacity, no more than 150 people, counter closed, patrons must sit. Tables, no bar games, nothing standing up that requires a standing,
like
no dine-in service
or something,
or pool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No dine-in service, 10 PM to 4 AM. effective 10 p.m. This Friday. And this Friday is Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. Talked a little bit about weddings, too, and the receptions and how
funerals. It really is. And it's, and you know, like you said, it's not the service itself where people are sitting, you know, 6 feet apart and their masks. It's the ceremonies afterwards. It's the get together afterwards where people are eating and drinking and talking and hugging and crying. And that's what's causing the increase of, in the rates.
Hey, before we get back to the show here, we want to take a break. But before we take a break, I just want to say one of the main things that he said that Governor Walz said is that we need to support our businesses. Mm-hmm. And he also is has $10 million supporting 1,000 or more businesses. And that's what they need to do. Yep. Because it looks like we might have some kind of a vaccine coming here in the next months. Wendy rolled her eyes.
I rolled my eyes because the healthcare workers are going to get it first.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
We're like last, well, not last on the list because we're older, but we'll get it before other people. But it's going to be a while.
Yeah. And my point is that we do have a vaccine as opposed to 2 weeks ago we didn't. So that's my
point. We have hopes
of
a good vaccine.
Exactly.
I don't want to play the downer, Debbie Downer, but okay.
All right. Thanks, Wendy. All right. Hey, let's take a break and then start the show. Rock the Vote Native Style. Thank you so much, Wendy, for stopping in. And next up, Nancy Bolio and
Thank
you. We are a Lusa Nation.
Hey, welcome to Rock the Vote Native Style here on the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. Hey, I want to just check and make sure my co-host Nancy's on. Nancy, are you there?
I am here in, the deep north and feeling a little more relaxed in this last few days, but can't forget there's work to do. So we can never let our guards down right now. But, you know, I think just seeing some of our relatives, you know, win their campaigns is something we worked really hard for. And just, you know, win or lose, all the candidates are always going to be there for their communities. And those that didn't win have planted a seed, Robert. And looking into the near future, we are going to build power and we're going to have that native wave that you and I talk about on the side. So it's time to get to work, Robert.
Exactly. I'd like to rest on my laurels for just a couple seconds before we get to our guest. And one of the things that was really exciting is that how the vote came out at Red Lake, the 9,000 people that you helped register, you and your posse help new voters register, Native voters up there. And then all across Turtle Island, we had the Native vote come out for the general election for the presidency in unbelievable numbers all over Turtle Island. This is the beginning of what we were probably going to call our next show, because I'm trying to design a t-shirt, is the Native Wave.
Right. And, you know, Robert, and you know, there's a lot of good energy going behind that wave right now. And that's what I'm excited about. You know, like you said, across Turtle Island, so many of our relatives got out and vote. And, you know, what we've learned in the last couple, you know, not just this election, but past elections, that we have to start showing up after we're done voting and hold on to that collective power and support our relatives running for office, you know, the ones that obviously that won, too. We got to support their work as they go be the voice for our people and bring us to the table. And just looking forward, you know, those guys winning, there's people out there inspired by that. And they're going to be running next. And who are they? And what are we all going to be doing in the future besides, you know, working for the change that's so much needed right now, Robert? So I'm excited to have, you know, candidates like our guest today.
And yes.
Just moving forward is the sunshine today, Robert. It warms my soul. Let's just put it that way. And again, you know, we're in northern Minnesota, and we actually got this $10,000 grant to move our work forward. I call it phase two, the $10,000 conversation piece. But the conversation, we're inviting our Bemidji City Council to the table, our Beltrami County Commissioners, our local, you know, the reservations, White Earth, Leech Lake, and Red Lake, the elected officials there, community leaders, people from all different, you know, areas, you know, that really matter to the change that we seek. And we're going to have the conversation, and it's built around four scenarios. You know, if you don't do nothing, all the way to the fourth scenario, if we do all this, this is what we can imagine, and this is what community looks like, and this is what we all need. But the topic is, what does the transition look like to for environmental and racial justice based around treaty responsibilities? So mm-hmm. on a local note, you know, change can happen. And so we're getting ready for that and looking forward to this conversation to happen. So at MN350, we have a small group of people that are working behind the scenes to put that piece together, and we're ready to take off with that the first week in December. So yeah,
wow.
Excited.
That is exciting. Hey, why don't you introduce our guest? Because like you say, the work is not done, and we want to support this young man any way we can. So why don't you introduce our guest?
All right. We got Dan Jordan. He is a band member of the Red Lake Nation, and he is running for our Bemidji Councilor at Large, which is kind of like the mini mayor's position. So he'll represent the whole city of Bemidji. So this is why it's important that we elect our fellow relative here in this position, because he is the voice of all of our people in town, not just our Native people, but, you know, I think he has a good heart, and he's going to work for the city. But most importantly, what matters the most, especially to a person like myself, is that he brings our voice to the table if he's elected. So I'd like to welcome in today Dan Jordan.
Hey, thanks for the warm welcome, Nancy. I can appreciate that as much as I can. And also thanks, Robert, for the time here this afternoon. I appreciate that as well.
Oh, yeah, we're really excited to have you on again. And maybe you can tell a little bit, a couple things. And one of the things is how we can support you, because I know you're still in election mode and still are running. Let our audience know right away how we can support you, and then let's get on with the interview.
Yeah, so we move forward into the primary election. We did really well. We were anticipating where we're going to move forward. So we did, which is great, which is amazing. It tells us a lot of things that we're doing right, and it tells us what we need to improve on the next time around. So I believe, you know, the community wants change. The community of Bemidji sees that type of change coming, and, you know, they just want to follow along. So for everybody else supporting, we want them to come to my Facebook page right now. There's a PayPal link attached to it. The Facebook link is facebook.com/electDanJordan. Once you go to the link, there's a PayPal attached to the top of it, and right there you can make your contribution to the campaign. And then, you know, like I said, we're still developing a brand new game plan here, and I think this one will be a lot more brighter, a lot more inspiring than the last one. The last one was great, so we're going to make it more greater than what it was. So that's our plan here, and we got 3 months left to go. February 9th, 2021 would be our general election for the city of Bemidji here.
Well, Nancy, one of the things I really love about Dan is his sincerity, and I feel his heart on the shows that we have had him on over the past few months, that he's a genuine person, right, Nance?
Right, you know, and I just shared, you know, his campaign just last night, or maybe it could have been this morning, I'm losing track of time. But, you know, what I noted was that give Dan a call, you know, because he's really so worth the conversation, because, you know, he brings good ideas to the table. He speaks from his heart, and he's going to be true to those words that he speaks. And so, you know, again, he just went through his primary election, and so we got 3 months to get that good word out there about Dan and why he's good for our city and really important to our change that we seek. And the good thing is we voted blue here in Beltrami County. So thinking about that, you know, it's like we can see that people are wanting something more. And I think we're going to be the county that's going to shine like a bright star and have that conversation, have great leaders like Audrey and Dan, you know, and even Emily on the city council. She's awesome ally peeps for us, you know, because her heart's with us. But just having these kind of people in these positions really makes the other work warranted and we're so worth moving forward, and that's why I'm excited to have people like Dan run for office. And I'm so willing to work hard for the next 3 months for Dan, just to get one more person to the table, because we deserve it, and he deserves it, and the future deserves it.
Absolutely. Hey, Dan, I know running for office 101, I've learned over the past few months, is that you have maybe three issues that you need to talk about constantly. And what are your three, two, or one major issues that you're running on?
Well, right now, after listening to Governor Waltz and his speech, what we learned from him is what we need to do in the city level as well of Bemidji. We need to focus on the health of everybody in the city, because we're seeing the numbers, we're seeing them rise intensively. So we want to take care of that first. And we understand it's going to be difficult. Not everybody's going to like the decisions on what the city needs to do, especially when it comes to our after-hours settings. So, you know, I think number one priority is the health and safety of the citizens within Bemidji. We need to look at that. We need to look at how we can contribute to the city and then to the state levels, where we are doing our part on that end. Once we get that, then we can, you know, say that we're doing our part and we're doing all we can to lower these numbers, because we don't want to see people in the community sick. We don't want to see our neighbors, surrounding reservations, come to our city in Bemidji and get sick or bring it back to the reservations. We want to find ways how we can, you know, collaborate better and create this safety network for everybody. And we understand the small business will probably, you know, take a little hit, but I believe that the governor laid out a good plan, that there is $10 million in funding that's going to be dispersed to the small businesses. So we get to look at our small business industry, how we can help them. And also on my platform that I do talk about public safety being a number one, having a law enforcement background myself, peace officer's license with the state of Minnesota. Bringing that to the table, I believe that needs to be addressed as well. Public affordable housing, which is a number one in our city. We see a lot of homelessness. We see a lot of low-income citizens in our town. So we want to take care of them, and we want to make sure that we're serving everybody on the table and make sure that everybody has a voice at the same time. So we have a lot of issues to work with in Bemidji. We want to include diversity on the table. We want to make sure that that's a platform. We want to make sure that everybody that's coming to our city for tourism and coming here and spending their dollars here and visiting, getting to know the city a lot better, we want to make sure that it's a good take home for them, where they can look back and say, hey, Bemidji's doing great. Bemidji's doing awesome with its work and its partnerships. And I believe that my platform, once we bring that, continue to bring that forward, that we can create this amazing energy, and also, you know, make sure that our Native American brothers and sisters and our surrounding neighbors have a voice once they come to the city as well.
Wow, Dan, thank you so much. And thank you so much for stopping in on, I think we're going to change the name to Rock the Treaties Native Style, but we'll have to vote on that, Nancy and I. But you can support Dan on his facebook.com/electDanJourdain. Thank you again, Pini Gigi, for being on, and we love helping you and watching you in this journey.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate all the support. Again, come to the Facebook page and donate a few dollars. The contributions are greatly appreciated, and these campaigns take a lot of financial costs, and we're looking forward to everybody supporting and you know, just getting everybody involved and getting them their voices heard is what we want to do. So at large position, it encompasses all of Bemidji. So there's five wards. We're roughly covering 15,000 citizens. So we want to make changes, guys, and we appreciate your support. We're going to make this happen, guys, and I want you guys personally to be a part of this change as well. So feel free to come contribute a few dollars if you can. I would appreciate that. Thanks again, guys.
Awesome. Hey, you're listening to Rock the Vote Native Style here on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Up next, Nancy and I.
Cafe Latte Combined. combines a cafe dining experience with gourmet quality food. And right now, Cafe Latte has reopened to indoor dining at 50% capacity. So come check out their pizza and wine bar, or get a treat from the bakery made fresh daily. Plus, you can still do online ordering and takeout, along with gift cards. Just go to cafelatte.com and choose from their ever-changing selection of award-winning salads, sandwiches, and soups. Cafe Latte is located off Victoria and Grand and online at cafelatte.com.
We are Alusa Nation. Welcome to Rock the Vote Native Style here on the Progressive Voice of AM 950. Nancy, wow, what a great guest. You've come up with so many great guests this election cycle. I just want to give you a huge shout out for that.
Well, McWitch, and you know, I was just thinking on commercial break, got to give a big shout out because we missed somebody, Robert, and his name is Rick Holland, and he actually won his campaign. He ran for Cass County Commissioner, and he's a White Earth band member. And, you know, I've known him for, I don't know, a good 30 years, since the 80s anyway. And he has a heart of gold. And when I heard he was running, it was the day of the elections. And it was like, how did we miss such an awesome candidate? I mean, we already had a lot, but we could always use more, right?
Exactly.
It's like, wow, my heart felt so good. It's like, you know, even though we missed it, that guy probably didn't need our help, Robert, but, you know, it would have been so nice to support him and put him out there so people can know him. Because what we've seen with working with the other candidates from the webinar on Sunday night is that they found a space where they can come together and do work together. And I think that's how we build some really awesome power, is creating spaces like that and supporting that kind of work. And listening, we have to listen, Robert. Sometimes we're not listening, and like right now, Line 3 is on the verge of, you know, maybe getting its permit this week, and not too many people are paying attention to the need for clean water, and some of us are out buying long johns and getting ready for all that. And it's like, be listen to you know, the things that your shows bring out. It's power, because knowledge is power, and that's how we as protectors know what we need to do when we listen. And so I think now, you know, especially with the change taking place, or that's slowly going to take place here, and the need to protect, you know, all that is sacred, we need to warrior up, Robert, and, you know, not just sit at home and make the phone calls, but we might have to show up on the front line, or even, you know, like maybe support Dan's campaign, throw him some money. All those kind of different things help put our people in positions where they can help make those decisions, you know, or stop things from happening, or, you know, being that voice at the table. So, yeah, I think we got a lot of work to do. And I think, you know, working with these candidates has brought some good insight and inspiration like no other, Robert. And I'm feeling good about the work, even though there's things out there that, you know, could seem like a threat in a way, you know, because I'm thinking today's Tuesday, and then what if they permit Line 3? Where am I at a week from now? I don't even know, Robert, but
you're live. You're going to be live on the phone, and I'm going to bring the studio up there. Nancy, you know, we only got a less than a minute to go here, and I just want to say Pini Gigi for all the hard work you've done. And I know Winona told me, I said, I'm going to go up there for Line 3, and we're going to do live radio, and we know how to camp. We know how to do all those things that we learned from Standing Rock. And she said, heck, there's hotels up here. You don't have to camp. And I went, hey, that even sounds better. But yeah, we're going to be laser sharp and laser beamed on what's happening with Line 3 up there. And I know you and the people you work with, and all those like Honor the Earth is up there. We are going to resist, divest, and run for office. Thank you so much. Can't wait for next week. And of course, you'll be on Native Roots Radio on Saturday, 1 to 3 here on AM 950. So Pini Gigi, thank you so much for everything you do.
All right. And back at you too, Robert, and all the listeners out there, because without, you know, an audience, we would be nowhere. And I think they play a big role in, you know, what we put out there and how it moves forward. So make which to all of our listeners as well.
All right. And thanks for the governor for making things clear and trying to protect our citizens. This has been a great show. We'll be back next week. See us, Pilots Progressive Party, tomorrow at 5, Wendy and I, and then Native Roots Radio, and then the Symposium on Sunday. We'll be back. See you later.